Okay, this is just a test. I'll start these both. All right. So, Ari, thanks again for Rabbi Lorge, thanks for joining me again. Ari's good for the interview. So one of the first questions that I have, again, the purpose of the interview is just to get a feel and an understanding for how people have witnessed changes within their own congregations or how they see people express their faith maybe in different ways due to COVID and the impact that it's had. And so the first question I've got for you is just with this spread of COVID, in what kind of ways have you or your congregation tried to reach out to one another to involve each other in the religious community?
I'll tell you, maybe is it worthwhile just to share a little bit about the community itself?
Yeah, sure.
Our congregation has about 2,500 families, so it's a pretty big congregation. We tend to gather throughout the week during normal times for classes and religious school worship, all kinds of different programming, justice work. So a lot of that really had to shut down when we realized, that this pandemic was spreading. And some of those opportunities have kind of translated into our ability to do some of that work online. We got very quickly our religious school up and running electronically, so classes were still able to happen, and our youth were still able to be engaged in that way. We had always screened our services out to the communities and beyond, so we were able to kind of shift that and to outfit all of us at home with different technologies. And, each week we got a little bit more adept at adding lighting or microphones to try to get, to try to increase the quality of our services to a little bit more approximating what people were used to worshiping with us. I think some of the outreach that's been most important has been the more personal, like one-to-one outreach. A lot of the community ends up being pretty isolated or feeling very shut in. We had a small subset of folks who you might categorize as shut-ins, right? People who really couldn't leave their homes beforehand due to illness or different things. We had a pretty, direct way of how to identify those people and attend to them and try to minister to them. When that all of a sudden becomes like most of your congregation, it's more difficult. So I'd say within about a month, we were able to train and identify leaders in the congregation who were going to serve basically congregant to congregant calls. And so we basically had a group of very involved members who ended up calling every other member family. So we've done about three rounds of those calls. So everybody in the community in the last 8 months or so has been called by another member at least two times just to check in and find out, are you still living where you're living? How are you doing? Are there pastoral needs? Are there more urgent housing, financial needs that are going on? What's going on in your family? Just trying to check in and get a sense of how people are doing. And that tended to unearth other ways that we ended up being able to interact with those folks or connect with those folks. And we've started now a round of specific clergy calls from our rabbinic and cantorial staff to the members who were able to kind of identifies folks who don't tend to show up a lot or haven't gotten so much attention and, tend to be more, for lack of a better word, peripheral members of the congregation. We're reaching out to them in another round of calls just to kind of follow up and see how they're doing. So those have been some of the more, I'd say, important engagement. And then a lot of the other stuff, we've mostly been trying to just kind of get back to where we were, life cycles, trying to figure out how to continue to have life cycle events happen, weddings, baby namings, bar mitzvah, things like that that would otherwise happen. We just had to very quickly find new ways to make all of that work. So I think it's both like the extra outreach that we're having to do during a pandemic because we're concerned about our people and we want to make sure they're doing all right. And then all the stuff that would be happening if it was regular, regular life, that we're just trying to keep going so people have that sense of normalcy, marking time, grieving celebrating the kinds of things you usually turn to a religious community for.
Yeah, and there's a lot of things in there that you mentioned that have come up in some of the other interviews, and things that I didn't even necessarily think of initially. Like, I think when a lot of people think about religious services, they just kind of think of, like, teaching the doctrine, like listening to some kind of sermon. And the more people that I've talked to, it seems like, you know, they express, like, although that's a part of it, and that's something that can be more readily kind of rectified by some kind of online platform, it's those kind of life ordinances that you're talking about, you know, the kind of rituals and those kinds of things that you do that have really been difficult. So it's good to see you've been able to kind of reach out in a lot of different ways. With with using social media, and it sounds like you said that you did use some of this before, and so that's really good. You had kind of that leg up on it. Do you feel like this is something that's going to be more involved in your community and your synagogue going forward?
Yeah, I mean, so I think the answer is yes. Our services have always been, you know, streamed out through our website. We had been on a cable TV channel called the Jewish Broadcasting Service, which is a national cable channel if it's carried. We were on Facebook Live, YouTube, stuff like that. So our services, and every now and then some classes and lectures, would get, you know, piped out to the world, but we dramatically ramped that up in the last 8 months. We started having a daily, we called it Coffee with Clergy, each different clergy person. We have about 9 or 10 rabbis and cantors on staff in different roles, but all of us basically signed up once a week or so, or you know, every other week to basically run a program of our choosing. And that ended up getting piped out. So we just started having many, many more touchstones during the day that people could kind of come and be a part of. The other thing is people, you know, there's nowhere to do that but our homes, because here in New York City, we were really locked down for a while. You know, you could go out for groceries or meds at a pharmacy, but that was pretty much it, unless you were an essential worker. So, people were just in our homes, for lack of a better way to, you know, explain it. People were in our homes for worship, and they were in our homes for these programs. So there was a sense of intimacy and getting a sense to know us that was more, and we ended up having to kind of produce more content. So I like pickling produce, and so I did like a whole pickling show that had several episodes to it, teaching people how to reduce food waste and kind of, make sure that they're able to kind of keep fresh produce around longer, or not so much fresh after you pickle it.
Yeah.
So I'd say, like, you know, some of it is, I think there is going to be more content that we put out in the world, and some of it is also trying to think about, you know, I'd say, you know, so we may have been putting our worship services out for, you know, people to watch, but our primary responsibility, we always felt, was to the congregation who was in front of us. And we had, you know, about 500, 700 people on a Friday night worship service. So, like, that was our community. And if people who are homebound or in hospitals or whatever reason were watching us on a screen, that was great. But our, you know, we planned services for the congregation who was in front of us. Now that the whole congregation has spent almost a full year just engaging with us over a screen, you know, we were wondering, you know, who's going to prefer it. Our audience is bigger than it was, because we do have the numbers. We have some rough numbers that are, you know, our viewership is up. So, you know, how do we create a hybrid model that honors the folks who are going to be walking into our building and the folks who aren't? And how do we program for both communities? You know, we don't have a membership for folks who aren't in our direct area also, because I think one of our, you know, one of the main things you come to a religious community for is pastoral care, life cycle moments, and we can't really do some of those things we've learned actually we can't do from a distance, apparently, you know, weddings, baby namings, and I never thought I'd do any of that distantly over a screen, and yet I have in the last several months, but, you know, we've done a lot of funerals in the last few months, and, that's something you just can't do from a distance. So I think we're wrestling with how this works in a hybrid world of, you know, technology being able to connect us in unusual ways.
I was going to say, especially with, like, those kinds of, what do you call them, family life cycle, those kinds of, like, life cycle events. Yeah, but, like, those, like, life cycle events, you know, I think those would be what's really tough to try to do over over a distance like this, and it sounds like you've come up with a lot of different solutions to try to assist with that. Which are the ones that you feel like have been the toughest? And you already kind of touched on the idea of funerals, and especially the intimate nature of and personal nature of, I would say, like a funeral. It's not something that you ideally want to do over like a Zoom meeting, something like this.
Definitely been some of the hardest work in the last several months. New York was an epicenter for a while. We had a lot of folks in our community who died from COVID. As a community, we've tried often to reframe things in a positive light, right? There are silver linings to some of this that, are worth noting, but there is just some stuff that is, that feels like a loss. And death and mourning is some of that. I mean, it's really hard not to be in the room with the mourners. It's really hard not to be able to hug these people who you know and care about, and you can see so much of Jewish mourning practices are about ensuring that people who are grieving are not alone. For 7 days, we're supposed to surround these people in their homes and, show up for them and show them that they're not alone and that we care for them, and, no matter what they're feeling, their community's there. And, we're not able to do that practice of Shiva, that practice of kind of going into a mourner's home for 7 days and surrounding them. So we try to approximate some of that stuff over Zoom. There's significant chunks of the time where mourners are alone, where we're not able to be around them, where, we're able to set up some times over Zoom to kind of do some of that work. But it's hard. And, I know as clergy we feel like that's a loss. I know from mourners they are hungry for that, and they try to do as much as they can that's meaningful. And I know that for our community it's hard, when it's somebody who would otherwise show up to their house with a meal or something and try to spend some time with them. And the most you can do is pop onto a Zoom screen, and you can't really schmooze or kibitz or, share, it's one person talking at a time. Otherwise, you get that cacophony on Zoom.
Yeah.
So it's been hard. But at the same time, for funerals or memorial services, people are able to come on from all over the world in ways that they haven't, right? There's been the ability to kind of gather community in a larger way that we wouldn't have otherwise done. So there are ways we try to leverage the technology for the good, even though it's been such a limitation around especially death and mourning.
Yeah, that's great that you've been able to come up with a lot of different, not necessarily solutions, but, ways in which you can, like you said, approximate, the way that things had been before, so you can give that feeling of, comfort that religion is so good at doing. And there's such an expectation that, the religion in these difficult times can be kind of that, that support. It's in New York. Talk a little bit more about, so like with restrictions, and so it's been really just kind of straight up just shut down for you then. What is allowed or has been typically allowed for you and your congregation?
Well, it's been a moving target, and I think we've been, one of our guiding principles is that, so much of Judaism and its practice centers on the idea that life is the most sacred thing, it's a gift, and we have to do everything we can to value that gift. And so we ended up shutting down the congregation to become a virtual congregation earlier than the city mandated it. Originally at the very outset, we started saying, look, here are the at-risk categories of people the CDC and others are telling us about. If you're over 65, if you have these kinds of health conditions, it sounds like you're more at risk. We would encourage you not to show up to services. Services is a big gathering. We've got hundreds of people, and as much as we'd love for you to be there, it just doesn't sound safe, and we'd urge you to be at home. Then we communicate that, and the next week, people who are over 65 and with those health care, because we know these people, we see them in the congregation, and we say, what are you doing here? And they say, well, nothing's going to stop me from, being part of my community. And we felt at that point like we had a responsibility to stop, because if they weren't going to stop on their own, we gotta do something to kind of make sure that we're not hampering anything from happening or being a help. So we shut down the congregation to become a virtual one. And then, you know, over the course of March, April, New York wrestled with a bunch of different measures, but eventually, you know, announced that the city was, you know, New York City was going on pause, I think they called it. And basically, gatherings were pretty much restricted. Only essential workers were allowed out. You could go get groceries, you could go get medication, things like that. But otherwise, you know, you really weren't supposed to be leaving. So we did services remotely from our homes. We did all of our programming remotely from our homes. Eventually, and I don't remember exactly what month it was in, we were allowed to have 10 folks in a gathering space at a time. And we started doing Friday night services, which for us had always been the most largely attended service. It's when our Sabbath starts. We were able to kind of bring our staff back into the building, so we would basically have the clergy leading services from the empty sanctuary. All our people of our community were still in their homes watching, but we were able to do things like sing together or, you know, just produce the service in a slightly different way because we were there in place. So we started doing that, and then by the time we got to the high holidays, we were able to have more staff involved. We still didn't feel comfortable with our community coming, and still haven't. Right now, New York would allow us, since we're a religious institution, to have a percentage of our total occupancy in the building. But that would, you know, if we did what the law suggests we could, I think we could have something like 300 people in our building, which to us just doesn't really seem prudent, right? And maybe if we can do it, does that mean we should do it? And as we, you know, and we've had a lot of conversations with the team about this, and you know, we argue about it, we debate it, because, you know, it's hard to know what's right or wrong right now. But I think at the end of the day, a majority of the team right now has just felt that if we know it's safer and we're still feeling like we're able to connect with people, you know, it's better to, you know, as staff, we can go in and do that, but we shouldn't be gathering 300 people or even, you know, 100 people. What we have done is for funerals, for B'nai Mitzvah, for baby naming, for those kinds of life cycle events, again, we are allowing 20 people to be in the sanctuary, masked, distanced, and we'll perform those ceremonies in those situations, but we're pretty strict on that limit. What's difficult is there's no uniform policy other than the maximum allowed. So, you know, what we're doing is going to be different from the synagogue or church or mosque down the way. So you might imagine communities pay attention to who's doing what. If such and such a congregation allows 100 people, why can't we have 100 people in our event and that kind of thing? So that's where it becomes a little tricky right now.
Yeah, that's really tough. Sorry about that announcement.
No, that's okay. I think my son's babbling away.
No, that's okay. Yeah, that's really interesting. I've been interested in talking to some other people about just like how congregations and people of faith have reflected on like the government's responsibilities in, or how do we respond to, you know, stipulations placed on our community. And it sounds like that's something that you guys have talked a lot about. And I'm sure that's something that's really tough. Do you feel like it's created any kind of tension, or as, you know, like a rabbi, do you feel like you have to kind of step in and try to guide the, you know, your congregation and understanding, like, this is the reasons why we're either going to support these measures or how we're going to support these measures?
You know, I think at the end of the day, people are really trying to come at it from a good place, and I think there's a lot of goodwill. We try to be very deliberate about explaining our reasonings behind different choices, because at the end of the day, now there are choices and not the governments anymore. You know, it was a lot easier when we could say, well, the state says this.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'd say there have been times when there's tension in the team as we're trying to discern what we think is the best. You know, we're all bringing a sense of worry about us and our own families. We're worried about the congregation. We're worried about our community members, and those things all collide. And then there's a level of tension sometimes between us and the, you know, different families who are maybe looking to celebrate or mark moments, you know. So 20 would mean, you know, somebody might say, well, 20 people might mean I'm able to come with my immediate family and grandparents, and then, you know, these aunts and not these uncles? You know, how am I supposed to make these choices? You know, and I feel for them. I mean, it's difficult. And I, we say we're mourning that too. We would want your entire family to be able to be here in this moment. I mean, for funerals too, you know, these people feel very close to the deceased. How can we tell them they can't come? But, you know, we are doing what we're trying to create guidelines that are sensible, that create an ability to mark these moments still. And we get guidance from people in our community who are hospital administrators and doctors. So we also are trying to ground it in something objective and scientific as much as possible. And what we've said throughout is that we're going to, as a community, at least in our congregation, we're going to err on the side of safety. We'd rather err on the side of safety than err on the side of, a looseness with the regulations, and then ultimately feeling like maybe we, in the worst case scenario, created a permissive atmosphere that allowed something to happen. So we'd rather people be angry at us right now for this than anything else.
I'm sure that's so tough, you know, but it's good to hear that, like, your congregation, that they have such a, generally speaking, like, a positive attitude towards it. They're coming at it from a good place, because it's not always been the case from what I've been talking to other people for, so.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's not just the impossible choices that people are having to make, but a lot of people, I don't know, I think there has been a national grieving and mourning process, not necessarily for people, not only for people who have passed away, a lot of people, people have passed away. But, I mean, so many of these families are mourning for things that they pictured happening a certain way in their family, And it's not happening that way, but it could be things that they've imagined for decades or for, since their child was born, that they pictured would be the way it was or the way that it had been just last year. And coming to terms with that is really hard, even when people are a little less reasonable than we'd hope they'd be, I feel for them and I know where they're coming from. There have been some hard conversations around it for sure.
Have you noticed, does anybody try to like put off, I mean, obviously you can't put off like a funeral, but like, weddings or maybe baby blessings, or are there some of those kinds of events you see people trying to put off, hoping that like in a month or in a couple weeks or, whatever it is, that then things are all going to be better magically? Do you see people try to push it off? Because like you said, it's not just mourning those that are gone. It's those lost opportunities. And I could see maybe people trying to push that off.
There were a lot of weddings that I had scheduled with couples and been working with couples, doing some marriage prep with them. And they had dates and they ended up, many of them, I've seen different things. A lot of them moved the date, pushed the date out, hoping to kind of have the wedding that they pictured. Slowly over time, a lot of those couples have come back and said, look, at this point, we just want to get married. We really love each other. Like, the circumstances around it don't matter so much. Let's just have the ceremony, and we'll figure out the celebration later. That's starting to happen a lot more. Originally, it was everyone was just pushing the date out and saying, the world's going to get back to normal. We'll do it then. And so we're seeing folks come back. The piece is hard for us is we have a lot of bar mitzvah students, and there's just not a way for us to reschedule the numbers that we have. We have somewhere between 3 and 4 b'nai mitzvah students a weekend, so there's not a lot of wiggle room to move people around. And it's one of those things where the tradition says you become 12 and 13, on that day you become a bar mitzvah is the day you reach maturity in the Jewish community, so you're beholden to all of the commandments and observances. And, the nice way to mark that is by taking on some of the most exciting ones, which for us is reading Torah. But you don't need to do that in order to have that coming of age moment. So, we've been trying to explain to our community and reframe it for our community that, there is something to be said about resiliency and continuing to choose life and to choose happiness and joy and to lean into that in hard moments. There are much darker chapters of Jewish history where Jews have become bar mitzvah because that's a relatively modern thing, but where Jews have come of age, and haven't had all of the beautiful trappings that we're lucky enough to have in America around services that we can have out in the open and to be a part of the fabric of the community. And so it's hard in a pandemic, but you know, it's not unprecedented for our people. So, you know, that's been helpful for some. But yeah, we've tried not to delay a lot of this stuff if we can avoid it.
Yeah, eventually you're going to delay it too long. It's like there's only so much you can do. I like what you were saying about, you know, like the Jewish people have been obviously through historically just so many different horrible, you know, events and been able to show their resilience. Do you feel like, especially in a time like this, are there particular stories that you find yourself turning to or moments in Jewish history that you turn to when you share with your congregation, kind of these uplifting moments to kind of give hope?
Yeah, since the beginning of the pandemic, you know, people, you know, it's a moment that begs people to start asking larger questions about themselves, whether they were, you know, attuned into a religious community or not, you know, and so I think we've definitely seen people searching for some kind of meaning making to be had from all of this, and you know, we try to address it in sermons, we try to address it in service, we try to address it in different ways. We had Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, our major holidays, this year, in September and October. So, you know, right in the midst of everything. And we revamped a lot of those services to try to key and tap into some of those kinds of things. And I wrote a whole opening to our High Holiday services, which our senior rabbi delivered, which was, kind of like a welcome into the space, and the sanctuary was empty, and we talked about, you know, exile as a theme in the, you know, in scripture and in our, you know, lives as Jews, and talked about, you know, a mishkan, a tabernacle, right, that the Israelites used and wandered with while they were wandering in the desert, and how, you know, that becomes the temple in Jerusalem, but it was originally something that was not rooted. It was, you know, it was something you could pick up and move around with you. And this idea that we create sanctuaries, you know, wherever we make the intention of creating a sanctuary. And so we encourage people to think about how they were creating sanctuaries in their living rooms so they couldn't be in the sanctuary with us. And so that theme of exile is one that I have been leaning on a lot. My sermon that holidays was about the destruction of the first temple in 586 BCE, and talking about how, you know, one of the response to that has been a prophetic response, which you see in Jeremiah and some of the other prophetic books, you know, of looking at the brokenness that had taken place in Jerusalem, but also seeing that the Jerusalem before the destruction had grown quite corrupt, and the things that had existed. You know, a lot of the prophetic voices talk about a return to Jerusalem and a rebuilding of Jerusalem, but they're not talking about rebuilding Jerusalem the way it was before the destruction, because it was quite a corrupt place, and they had quite a lot of negative views about what they saw happening in society around them and in the temple and things like that. So their reimagined Jerusalem was a better Jerusalem. And I tried to use that as a framework for what we're seeing in America, you know. The fact that during the pandemic, you know, one of the conversations in New York City was, you know, well, we need to close the public schools because we think students are inadvertently bringing COVID to elders in their homes, right? But then if you close the school systems where there's a lot of kids who, you know, survive on meals, breakfasts, and lunches in school cafeterias, you're basically going to starve children. I mean, that's a ridiculous, terrible choice to have to make in 2020. It's not a morally embarrassing choice that we have to make in America in 2020, that's something that we face. That's not, you know, the city's going to have to be rebuilt. It wasn't raised to the ground, but if we're having to reconstruct society and our norms and our values, I mean, we have to not get back to normal. We have to do better than that. So I tried to use that as a way to kind of think about the months after the pandemic, too, and what does it mean to try to rebuild.
That's awesome. That's a great perspective about, you know, reimagining, you know, how we would do things, and not just to go back to the way things were, but to create it anew, to create it stronger, better than it was, so it can resolve hopefully some of these problems if they surface again, like in the future. Do you feel like with your congregation, and I know you've touched on this a little bit before, But have there been many outreach programs to try to assist those people, not just spiritually but temporally, because of the people that have like lost their jobs and are having a difficult time trying to just take care of those basic needs?
Yeah, so I'd say, you know, two levels. I think there's some programming that we've been doing prior to the pandemic that remains necessary, important work. So we had been, you know, since the 80s, we've had a program where we serve a hot meal and then a bagged meal. We're part of a consortium, I guess, of churches and synagogues in our area who make sure that every day of the week, every meal of the day, there's a place you can come for a meal. So that work, we found a way to continue throughout the pandemic, even as things were shut down, which felt like a necessary and important thing. And those numbers have increased in terms of the numbers of people who we're serving right now. So that's continuing. We do more systemic justice work around criminal justice reform. And, you know, a lot of the reports coming out of prisons and other populations that are incarcerated, we just see that's a community who has not been cared for or looked after amongst all this. And COVID's really ravaged those communities. So we're doubling down and kind of reinvesting in efforts to try to think differently about criminal justice in New York City and in America. So some of that stuff is kind of sustaining work we've already done. And then, you know, we're, I don't think we're fully seeing yet the full scope of what's going to be needed. We know that, you know, the numbers of unhoused, of food insecure people are on the rise. You can see it very visibly as you walk around the streets here in the city. There's going to have to be effort, both direct service and more systemic effort that's going to have to be at trying to help people out economically. You know, we're identifying and trying to identify folks in the community, you know, in our specific community who we can help because we, you know, are able, you know, we're able to help in a more direct, quick way. You know, there's things, you know, as little as, you know, it costs some money to become a member of our congregation so we can, you know, relieve dues and help lower those costs for people who are hurting in the short term. We have some funds to be able to help people with more acute needs like rent and food. We try not to do it in a way that is going to be perpetual because we want people to be able to get back on their feet. So we try to do it in conjunction with other efforts. We have a social worker on our staff who helps connect people to services that they need. But I think, you know, as we're starting to identify and really try to help with the needs of people directly in our community, you know, we feel responsible to the larger community around us. So we're just starting to have conversations with other faith communities with whom we partnered in the past to try to think about what's going on systemically. But I think ultimately there's going to have to be some kind of a push towards something federal and something statewide to try to help. And we'll try to be a voice holding some of our government officials account to try to do something. I think we were all pretty disappointed to see the Senate and Congress go on vacation without any kind of relief for the American people. So we'll probably end up at some point getting vocal in that work.
I say, in terms of getting vocal, like, have you seen much of a, especially within like the church leadership or maybe encouraging regular members of the congregation, have you seen a lot of this kind of like interfaith work to try to encourage different political officers, local or, you know, federal, to become involved, to kind of let them know what your concerns are, both in regards to restrictions in the church, but also in the needs of the members of the community?
So we haven't done a whole lot, you know, in terms of restrictions. You know, we felt that most of the, you know, restrictions that have been put on, you know, our congregation or our congregations in general have been relatively loose, not particularly restrictive. You know, I know there's quite a loud case that went to the Supreme Court recently around some of the restrictions in New York City. It wasn't our part of the city had those kinds of restrictions because we hadn't been deemed a red zone, but we had lived under similar ones when the whole city was shut down. You know, I think for us, it'd be different. I think, you know, we're a liberal Jewish community in the sense that we're happy to use technology even on the Sabbath. An Orthodox community might feel less so. Though I've seen more and more Orthodox and conservative Jews start to, you know, in a moment of unprecedented need, use the technology, you know, but it's not their preference. You know, we're comfortable to do it, and we're, you know, we don't feel restricted in doing it, and so, you know, we haven't been trying to lobby against those efforts. We think they're sensical. But in terms of, you know, we have been part of interfaith coalitions in the past, and we'll continue to be on some of the, you know, justice issues that we care about. We've been working on New York was one of two states, along with North Carolina, that would allow 16-year-olds to be incarcerated with adults. So we were a part of a coalition with many other houses of worship and a few other organizations to try to get that law changed, which we were able to successfully do. Governor signed a law making that no longer the case, and then we're working on bail reform and a few other issues locally here. But you know, we'll probably try to continue to you know, I think it's more powerful to act and to speak with other diverse communities, and I think it's you know, the faith community can be a really powerful community when it draws itself together. And elected officials, I think, still feel uncomfortable when they're held to account by, you know, a pretty broad-based coalition of faith communities, which is good.
Yeah, yeah. Do their job, right? It sounds like the church and community has done a lot from kind of the top of the group. What do you see going on from, like, the base, from just kind of the lay population? Is there, like, any, not necessarily, like, specific stories to share, but, like, is there been kind of surprised, maybe happily surprised, maybe, you know, thought kind of disappointing you'd like to see within just kind of the regular membership and reaching out and supporting those needs, be it spiritual or material or whatever?
Yeah, you know, I think one of the, you know, we have a lot of congregants who are aging and, you know, trying to figure out how to handle distance. And there's a person in particular who I speak with somewhat regularly, who's kind of on my watch, I care about. And she's in her 90s. She lives alone. And it's a really hard 8 months. And a lot of folks in that population have kind of expressed, you know, if I knew this was what the last few years of my life were going to look like, I don't know that it'd be worth it, which is a hard thing to hear. But I've seen, not with my prodding or asking, a lot of different members just proactively be reaching out and setting up times to call. Now that, you know, it's getting colder again, but it was, you know, we had a great spell of weather for many months to go on, you know, distance walks with her, get her out of her apartment. They have, you know, you can eat outdoors now in restaurants around here, so people have been doing that with her. And, you know, I think she probably gets, you know, a few calls a day. It makes a world of a difference. And I'd say, you know, this is true, I think, of any religious community. The people who I think are reaping the benefits of that are the people who tended to invest in the community beforehand, right before the crisis. You know, she's somebody who had become a really integral part of the community. She showed up to a lot of things. She had a long history of being a part of the community, and so she's known, and people care about her and worry about her. And there's others, people, and I know that there are other people in similar situations who maybe are on more of the periphery, who, you know, were happy to be a member of the congregation but didn't particularly invest in the community in any way. It's harder. You know, we have people who are happy to make phone calls. We have people who are happy to check in. I do think, you know, there's a different level of care or concern or commitment that people have when they feel like it's an organic relationship that they've developed over time versus something that they're doing, you know, we'd say out of chesed, out of love or grace or a sense of it being the right thing to do. So, you know, I think it's also, this whole thing has been a reminder to some folks about, you know, what is the power and strength about being in part of a faith community? And I think, you know, we've seen for decades a decline in people wanting to affiliate, you know, across all denominations and churches for the most part. You know, that had been sort of the working sociology was that, you know, American faith was in decline outside of maybe evangelical circles or something like that. But even evangelical churches, I think, in the last 10 years have said that too. I think moments like this kind of remind people about what you miss when you're living alone, you know, and not outside of the community.
Yeah, do you think that, and that's something that I've heard a lot about and I've thought about even just within my own faith, do you feel like this is going to, because of an event like this, that I think a lot of people are going to remember the rest of their lives, you know, like back in 2020 when everything shut down and, you know, all the kind of craziness of it, do you feel like this could have had ultimately a positive or negative influence on individual faith? It seemed like you kind of addressed this a little bit. It's probably a little bit of a mixed bag, right?
Yeah, it's a mixed bag. I'd say, I hope a positive. I think it's, you know, it depends on people's experience, right? I think, you know, if I was to do a poll of my community, I hope that they'd say that they felt like we've been, you know, serving them well, that they've found a benefit and a good out of being a part of the community during this time. And I think if that's true, and if that's true for most people, then, you know, we'll see the rewards of that. You know, if we were able to, right, I mean, if religious community can't help people through challenging times, we're really failing at our mission. And so I think when we do well, people notice and they talk about it and they see it and they want to be a part of that. So I think if we're doing our job well, and if we're, you know, kind of fulfilling our mission, hopefully, you know, people will more engaged, more attuned, they want to pay it forward, they want to be able to give back, they want to be able to live their values out in a way that's meaningful and authentic. But, you know, if people feel more alone, less connected, the other thing that I think that's hard is there's a theological question in all of this, which is, you know, what caused this? Why is it happening, right? And I've heard a lot of different people who maybe would have scoffed at ideas about theology and God, you know, all of a sudden, you know, the superstition in them says, well, I don't know, what did cause this? And one person who I call regularly says they think this was a punishment from God. That's not my theology, and I try to warn her away from that theology because I don't think it's a helpful one. It's not particularly a liberal Jewish theology at all. But I do think, you know, there is, I think, a renewed sense of people asking questions about what is the meaning behind life and living, and when you realize how fragile everything is, you ask different kinds of questions, and I think people hadn't quite seen that fragility that was baked around us in the system that we live in, and now they can't help but notice it. We have a holiday in Judaism called Sukkot, sort of feast of booths, that's all about kind of recognizing how fragile life is, and I feel like this time has been a really long, protracted Sukkot, where it's just like, you know, everything is tenuous, and it's been a crazy reminder of how tenuous everything is. And there's a way to lean into that and still find joy, which is all about what Sukkot is about. It's about finding an ability to, even in a fragile life and in a fragile world, to still be able to wrestle out joy and blessing and goodness and feel meaning and purpose behind it. So if that's people's experience through religion in this time, then I think it'll be really good.
That's awesome, man. It sounds like you're doing an amazing work with a lot of those people, really making a positive influence in them. Just with the, kind of the last couple of minutes that we have, is there any particular topic or idea that you would like to address or something that you found interesting as we've kind of navigated our way through, hopefully as we're nearing the end, but who knows, right, as we're navigating our way through this kind of journey of 2020?
I think one of the questions asked about different age demographics and their responses to this, that struck me just because I do a lot of work with our teens, and I do think, I don't think this is necessarily a religious thing in the sense that I think teens are having a really hard time. I was curious as a teacher yourself, you know, if you've seen that in your students, but in the students I work with, I'm definitely seeing a lot more anxiety. You know, I'm not a clinician, but a lot of people are, feeling, we're trying to communicate to our community as we head into the winter here in New York. You know, we're not able to get out as much. It's darker earlier. We're trying to tell adults this and stuff like that, things that they should be on the lookout for depression and anxiety, because we've noticed a real spike amongst adults and teens. So, you know, we have a whole new renewed program that we just kind of came up with in the last week and a half, trying to, or I guess a month now, really, 3 weeks, trying to address what we're seeing, because it's kind of morphing from, you know, trying to take what we're noticing and apply it and be flexible enough to meet the needs we're seeing. I don't know if you see that.
Yeah, you know, it's been something shocking where more than any other year, this is my 10th year teaching, but there's just the apathy of students. And it's surprising, even in little things, like if I give them, you know, 10 minutes at the end of class to work on an assignment, in a typical year, you know, kids would be kind of working, but also socializing and talking and stuff. And now when I give them time to work, it's just quiet. And it's like part of me is like, oh, it's nice. You know, it's quiet. And sometimes I'm just like, but part of that bothers me and makes me worried for them, because so many of them, even when they are in the midst of so many people, are isolating themselves. You know, they don't chime in with questions, I think, because they feel like the mask is a hindrance, or it just gives them an excuse not to say anything. And the number of students struggling is certainly higher than I've ever seen, and I think that a lot of it is in part due to that. And as a faculty and as teachers, we try to, you know, come up with different ways to try to engage students with us. And been now just shutting down this week again for a second time, in anticipation for it, I was letting students know, you know, there's a decent chance that this is going to happen again. And the first time it happened, I think a lot of students treated the shutdown as though, like, I'll figure out my grades and everything afterwards. And they kind of dug themselves in a hole, and now they think they realize kind of the reality, like, this year in school still does count. And, like, I need to figure things out, but now many of them do feel like they can't talk, or they don't want to talk, or they just are dealing with so many difficult things. And a lot of students, I think, play it off as though it's just that they don't care, like, oh, it's just school, whatever. Some of them really are struggling with being home. And like you said, I think it's missing out on what this year should have been, not going to homecoming, not going to football games, not going to, you know, the kinds of high school. These are valuable years in these kids' lives, and for them to miss out on this, it just really is difficult. And so it's nice to see when you do find those successes and you're finding a way to create something that's not the ideal, but you can approximate what you had hoped to be able to get, and you can see the happiness. And I've been really encouraged by how many students have reached out to me, emailed me, and just said, hey, thanks, you know, thanks for supporting us in these difficult times. Thanks for understanding. Thanks for validating my feelings, for, you know, those kinds of personal moments that I think, especially in faith communities, you're able to touch people and let them know that the people are thinking about them, people care about them. And I think that's what's almost been as important as anything. Obviously, academics matter in my profession, but I think equally important, I want my students to know that I care about them and the community cares about them, and that we want to help through these difficult times as well. So definitely, yeah, with teenagers, it's a tough age group, and I know they're struggling for sure as well. And that's why I'm glad that they have more than just a school. There are religious, you know, faith groups that they can help promote them as well. Because not everybody has a good home life. Not everybody has, right, you know, that support from home. So they need those extra people to step into their lives and to kind of help fill those roles. I don't think we could ever fully take on the role of maybe father or mother or whatever, but to be as best as we can and show them that care and concern. Well, thanks, man. I, you know, again, I really appreciate it. It shouldn't have taken this long for me to reach out to you.
No worries. I'm really glad.